When historians around the globe look back on the Trump presidency, what will be his legacy? Some say it will be a few hours on January 6th.
A president has ended his term by summoning a mob to storm the Capitol to overturn a legitimate election. I think that will be his legacy.
Also today, a member of Congress reflects on the sacking of the Capitol.
What stays in my mind is how little my life is worth to people like President Trump.
And America's top infectious disease expert says more international cooperation remains a top priority.
Viruses, they don't know borders at all. So since they don't know borders, we sort of have to act like we don't know borders and we're all in this together.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. How can one of the most secure buildings in the world fall so easily? That's a question we're grappling with in the aftermath of the sacking of the U.S. Capitol. The story is bigger than just one building, though. Wednesday's incident raises questions about broader American national security. We've asked Michelle Flournoy to weigh in on this. She was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy during the Obama administration. Michelle, first of all, in a post-9/11 context, how was this mob able to pull this off?
It's really quite stunning and quite a disgrace. It was no secret that President Trump had called for this rally on the day that the Congress was going to validate the Electoral College votes, that he was going to stir up his followers at the rally, and he actually encouraged them to march up to the Capitol. What's mystifying is why was that not planned for and prepared in advance? I think that will have to be the subject of some investigation.
But I would think, even without additional planning, that security would be too tough for a mob to breach it, especially post-9/11.
You would think so. I've certainly gone through Capitol Hill security countless times, and, you know, I actually have a, you know, artificial hip, and that sets off the metal detectors every time. So how they got overwhelmed, it really is a mystery. It's a terrible mismanagement and a terrible failure that I think has created one of the worst moments in the history of our democracy, to have the Capitol, you know, the heart of our democracy, overrun by an angry, violent mob.
According to recent reports, in the days and hours ahead of the mob that stormed the Capitol building, Capitol Police leaders turned down resources and offers of support from the Pentagon and the FBI. But can the Pentagon or the FBI step in independently based on their own intelligence?
I mean, that's a good question. Usually the deference is to the Capitol Police, but I think the D.C. police also had a key role to play. And I know that the mayor was begging for assistance from both federal law enforcement and the National Guard. And it took quite a number of hours for those requests to be responded to. You know, my biggest worry, Carol, is how the world sees this beyond what happened here at home, which is terrible enough. But this really sends a terrible signal to the rest of the world.
What are the potential things that could be stoked in these waning days from outside the U.S., from countries that aren't so fond of us?
Well, I think the top concern has been actions by Iran. We're around the one-year anniversary of the killing of the head of the Iranian Republican Guard, General Soleimani. You know, I think that anniversary has raised concerns that Iran might try to assassinate a U.S. official traveling in the region or attack U.S. assets or embassies in the region. That hasn't happened so far. I think U.S. forces have been put on alert in the region to watch for that. But if they believe that we are consumed internally, that might encourage them. I think longer term, the biggest concern I have is with China and Russia. They both like to perpetuate and proliferate this narrative of U.S. decline. And you can be sure that the new state-run media in both countries are running the clips of the insurrection and the mob violence on the Capitol over and over and over again, not only to undermine U.S. credibility, but to discredit democracy itself. And that's a very harmful impact.
How about within the White House, possible things that could go wrong there or possible provocations or errors President Trump could make given his access to sensitive information, the nuclear codes, et cetera, et cetera?
I think the biggest danger is that he tries to change the subject and kind of be the tough guy by ordering some kind of military action somewhere. With his state of mind and this president, given his unpredictability and his willingness to put his own interests ahead of the United States' interests, you can't rule that out as a possibility.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because there are reports that some people inside the Trump administration are concerned about the president's state of mind and what he might do in the remaining days of his presidency, like tampering with classified information. Are you concerned about that?
I am. I mean, we've just witnessed a U.S. president for the first time in history incite insurrection and violence on the United States Capitol. This is a person who is not in the right frame of mind to be president of the United States and unable to act in the best interests of the country rather than just what he perceives to be his own best interests. And I think that's what has caused some commentators to raise the prospect of invoking the 25th Amendment, others saying he should go down to Florida and stay there and delegate powers, the remaining powers of the presidency, to Pence for the duration. But this is a man who has clearly demonstrated he's in a very dangerous frame of mind.
What do you think should be done over the next 12 days? What steps do you think should be taken or would make you feel better?
I would like to see him step back and delegate as much power as possible to Vice President Pence. I would like to see leadership in Congress, particularly the Republican leadership, come out much more strongly in an effort to constrain his action. This is about preserving our democracy and protecting it. That should guide all of our actions. I will say one silver lining, you know, as badly battered and beaten up as the institutions were, the truth is the system held. The members came back. They did the work of the people. They validated the results of the election. And now it's well understood that Joe Biden will become the president on January 20th. So the system did have the strength and resilience to go forward. But boy, we have a lot of repair work to do going forward.
Michelle Flournoy was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy during the Obama administration. We've been talking to her about the national security repercussions in the aftermath of the Capitol building breach. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Carol.
One of the lawmakers who was inside the Capitol building when it came under siege by the mob of Trump supporters is Norma Torres.
The incident that unfolded at the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday, I think, will stay in my mind forever.
Torres is a Democrat from the 35th District in Southern California.
And what stays in my mind is how little my life is worth to people like President Trump, who sent these people to the U.S. Capitol to do us harm. We will never, ever forget this incident for as long as we live.
You said something very personal there, that you feel like this was really an attack on you and who you are. I want to share something you wrote on Twitter. You wrote, quote, "I immigrated from Guatemala to get away from violent attempts to dismantle democracy and the rule of law. It's extremely disturbing to see this happening in our country." Congresswoman, what were you trying to get at in that tweet?
I think what we see too often happening in Guatemala, not just in Guatemala, but in the Northern Triangle, and the reason why so many of the people from that region flee and are asking for asylum, is the fact that we have dictators in those countries that constantly work against the best interests of their own people, rulers that don't stand up for the rule of law. So this incident very much put me in that mindset that our Constitution, that our democracy, that our country is worth fighting for, because I never want to see the United States of America become what we see in the Northern Triangle.
And do you feel like the attack of Congress was also an attack on, as you said, people like you, people who are immigrants?
Absolutely. The people that came to the Capitol to do us harm were homegrown domestic terrorists. They have chosen to believe the lies that every single day Donald Trump tells them. And I think that is so dangerous. This incident really is a telling story of the last 4 years and where we are and what we have to work to undo all of this hate that this president has brought.
There are a few ideas getting traction about how to respond to President Trump's behavior this week. A lot of talk about impeachment. Do you think the president should be impeached and removed in these last 2 weeks before he leaves office?
I think that we should invoke the 25th Amendment.
And the 25th Amendment is an amendment which allows for the vice president to become president for a short while if the sitting president becomes unable to do the job. It's something that has to be invoked by the vice president, Mike Pence. What if he doesn't invoke it? Will you move to impeach?
We have 13 days. I think the quickest way to deal with what we have seen coming out of the White House is to move forward with the 25th Amendment. The actions that this president has shown are irresponsible, criminal, and outright dangerous for the future of our country.
Congresswoman, after Joe Biden takes office, how can the Democratic-led Congress address priorities like Homeland Security so that Wednesday's events don't happen again?
I think one of the things that we can move forward on is a project that the FBI has already started, and that is identifying infiltration of white nationals in law enforcement.
Are you suspecting that that was the case on Wednesday, that there are sort of people who sympathize with or support white nationalists within the D.C. police force?
I don't know specifically exactly what happened. What I do know is that members of Congress were on the floor, crawling, asking for help to deal with the chaos and the violence that was brought to the doorstep of the U.S. Capitol. Something really terrible happened there. Was it on purpose? I think that it's worthy of an investigation. Why is it that Homeland Security failed to protect members of Congress while doing our duty?
If these kinds of security issues aren't prioritized, what's at stake here? What happens if we see extremist groups grow in power?
I'm very, very concerned about the next 13 days and what happens on January 20th. And that is, you know, my only one and only reluctance of having to go through an impeachment process. I don't want anything to stand in the way of Congress working with Capitol Police, with the D.C. police, to figure out what went wrong and how can we fix it to ensure that the people who are coming to Washington, D.C., whether it is to demonstrate or to try to cause violence and aggravate and hurt people are dealt with in the way that those incidents should be dealt with.
Are you concerned about something happening on Inauguration Day? I mean, are you worried sort of each day leading up to that?
I am worried about each day leading up to that. I think that any threat against our Constitution, against our democracy, should be taken seriously. Don't tell me that you didn't know that there were full flights coming into Washington, D.C., that hotels were beginning to be booked, and that we were expecting a large group of people to come and demonstrate, whether they were going to be peaceful demonstrators or violent demonstrators, as they've shown to be. We should have been better prepared, and we were not.
Democratic Congresswoman Norma Torres represents the 35th District in Southern California. Congresswoman, thanks so much for your time.
Carol, it's been great talking to you. Take care.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's time now for our Friday chat with our friends at The Economist and Economist Radio. Each week, we check in to find out what stories they're working on and how they're covering them. This week, John Fasman, the U.S. digital editor for the magazine, joins us. John, it's been about 48 hours since a mob stormed the Capitol building in Washington. What message did that send around the world? I mean, specifically about the divisions in our country.
Well, I think that Americans were shocked to see the sorts of messages that we're used to seeing our State Department send to other countries when they have fractious elections being sent to us. We've seen expressions of concern coming from Boris Johnson of Britain, from Justin Trudeau in Canada, from Jens Stoltenberg in NATO, and really from around the world. It's been a real shock for Americans to see the images they've seen and to sort of have themselves be seen around the world in a way that they're not used to. Our democracy has been a hallmark of stability around the world for decades, and that has been shaken. That will take a long time to get over.
Now, after order was restored at the Capitol, Congress got back together within hours and certified the vote to ratify Joe Biden as the next president. Does that point to a sign that democracy still works?
Well, our institutions held up. I guess that is the silver lining here, is that our institutions held up. They were put under tremendous strain. But, you know, I think a lot of people are asking themselves, with justification in my view, what happens if in 2024... a Democrat wins the presidency and Republicans hold the House and the Senate? Will they refuse to certify him or her? Will they use the same sort of procedural maneuvers they did now? Now, I think that in any other year, the question of whether Congress would certify a duly elected president would be a non-question. But it isn't now. And that is, I think, a concern that a lot of people are going to have over the next 4 years because of what we've just seen.
I know the latest issue of The Economist has a big headline on the front page called Trump's Legacy. What do you think Trump's legacy is?
This is. What we just saw is a president has ended his term by summoning a mob to storm the Capitol to overturn a legitimate election. I think that will be his legacy.
Do you have any sense whether our allies consider Donald Trump to have been a kind of one-off phenomenon, or are they concerned that there's an undercurrent in American society now that will continue his policies or his beliefs?
Well, I can answer that question in two ways. The first one is that we are compiling a piece right now, today and over the weekend, that will look into just that. But I will say one thing that has stuck in my mind is that before I was the U.S. digital editor, from 2014 to 2017, I was the Southeast Asia bureau chief. And I happened to be reporting a story in Indonesia when Donald Trump, as a candidate, announced his Muslim ban. And the reaction from my sources and friends, my Muslim sources and friends in Indonesia, was just utter bafflement and sadness. It wasn't anger. It was a confusion that this could be the case in America, that America, they knew, stood for religious freedom. There was no religious test. While there was, of course, they had seen sort of undercurrents of Islamophobia in the United States before, there was a sense that that was not official policy. Donald Trump changed that. And I think a lot of people sort of started to see America differently when he was a candidate and throughout his presidency. Changing that perception back is going to be Joe Biden's most urgent task on the world stage.
John Fassman is U.S. digital editor for The Economist. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
The turmoil in Washington is what most people are focused on, but the world keeps spinning. We've got one story now that might have been overlooked. The World's Roopa Shenoy reports on a development in the long-running standoff over the future of Tibetan Buddhism.
2020 marked 70 years of Chinese occupation of Tibet, and the Tibetan government in exile says the situation in the country is only getting worse. They say in the last 6 months, Beijing has forced more than 500,000 rural Tibetans into military-style training camps, similar to the ones holding Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
China has essentially locked down, closed off a really significant portion of the world. I mean, Tibet is not a small mountain kingdom. It's a vast area.
Canadian Tibetan Laden Taitong directs the Tibet Action Institute.
Tibetans inside desperately are hoping for some stronger, you know, global support and intervention.
It's taken years of rare bipartisan cooperation, but now the U.S. has quietly taken a step that draws a red line for the Chinese in Tibet. The policy change was buried in the $900 billion spending bill President Trump signed late last month. It says that if Chinese Communist Party officials try to interfere with the reincarnation process of the Dalai Lama, the U.S. will impose economic and visa sanctions.
This, for Tibetans, is a huge win because it sets sort of a precedent globally that it's one thing to tell the Chinese government, as many governments do, that this shouldn't be done and that they shouldn't do this. But to actually put some consequences, real consequences, just changes the game.
To truly understand the significance of what the U.S. has done, we have to back up a bit for some context. At 85 years old, the current Dalai Lama remains Tibetan Buddhism's supreme spiritual authority. The title of the reincarnated leader who will succeed him is the Panchen Lama. The monk who was first identified as the current Dalai Lama's Panchen Lama successor died suddenly in 1989. Soon after, the Dalai Lama identified the young boy with the Panchen Lama's reincarnated spirit, who would be his new successor. But within days, that boy disappeared.
He, along with his parents, were last seen in May 1995. He was then 6 years old.
This is a documentary narrated by actor Patrick Stewart for the International Campaign to Free Tibet. Their cause has drawn a lot of support, as the boy the Dalai Lama named Panchen Lama has reportedly been held in Chinese state custody. Meanwhile, Communist Party officials chose another boy as the Panchen Lama, naming him the Dalai Lama's successor.
The boy chosen by the Chinese government is not accepted by the Tibetan Buddhists.
But over the years, Chinese state media has featured videos of thousands of people gathering to see its Panchen Lama. These were his greetings on the 2020 Tibetan New Year.
I wish and pray for the prosperity of our country. I wish and pray for the health and well-being for our people.
Puchung Tering, vice president of the International Campaign for Tibet, says if that man became the Dalai Lama, China would seek to control millions of followers across the world through him.
The U.S. government is mainly saying that the Chinese government should respect Tibetan Buddhist tradition.
Tering helped shape the new U.S. policy that would punish Chinese officials if they try to install their successor when the Dalai Lama dies.
The Chinese government now has got the message that they will not have an easy path of asserting their authority if they plan to do that.
The new policy also instructs the State Department to deny China any new consulates in the U.S. until a U.S. consulate is established in the Tibetan capital, Lhasa.
It has a political message of telling the Tibetan people the United States is very much to act as a watchdog on the Chinese government's policies.
China has responded angrily, saying the U.S. is interfering with its internal issues. For his part, the Dalai Lama has told the BBC that he'd rather see his position end than be controlled by China.
So much better. The century-old tradition ceases at the time of quite popular Dalai Lama.
For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
And this is The World. The events this week were sad for many Americans. For some in other nations, though, it was a chance for some finger wagging.
To kind of get back at the U.S. because they're normally being lectured by the State Department about their elections or instability or things like that.
And lessons learned from vaccination drives for other diseases. It's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. Some major news today in the fight against the coronavirus. President-elect Biden says he'll release all the doses of the vaccine when he takes office, rather than holding back shots for people to get a second dose. It's a strategy with some risk. The vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna were designed for two doses. But with so much of the supply currently unused, Biden is essentially betting that we can get more people vaccinated and still have enough to go around for a second dose. Biden's decision comes a day after another grim milestone in the U.S., 4,000 COVID-related deaths in a single day. And the nation's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, warns the next few weeks are only going to get tougher. I spoke with Dr. Fauci, who will be part of the Biden administration team in charge of managing the pandemic. I asked him how he sees a way forward to manage the pandemic when we can't get politicians and citizens to really understand the problem.
There's politics, but there's also divisiveness in society. That's something that's going to take a while to correct. I mean, obviously, we've got to keep politics out of public health measures. There's no place for that. They do nothing but interfere. But we have a lot of work ahead of us to get the country together and pulling together in an effort to end this outbreak and just put aside things like the politicization of wearing of masks and doing other public health measures.
WHO Director Tedros Ghebreyesus said this week that the world has entered a new phase of the pandemic where solidarity is needed like never before, that we're in a race to save lives right now. What does that mean to you, and how do you assess this period we're in?
You know, I think we were in this period all along. Whenever you have a global pandemic, you have to have solidarity between countries, because what affects one country in one part of the world, when you're dealing with a communicable disease that has a high degree of efficiency in transmitting from person to person, you have to have interconnectedness with regard to cooperation, collaboration, and solidarity, because viruses, particularly viruses like SARS-CoV-2, that are spectacularly efficient in their ability to transmit, they don't know borders at all. So since they don't know borders, we sort of have to act like we don't know borders and we're all in this together.
I mean, can we vaccinate our way out of this pandemic?
You know, the answer is yes. Just the way we have vaccinated our way out of multiple public health threats, such as smallpox, polio, measles, and a number of others. So when you're dealing with communicable diseases, infectious diseases, very often the gold standard of how to really crush these outbreaks is by getting a safe and highly efficacious vaccine. We are very fortunate in that we already have two, and likely we'll have more than that, vaccines with a very high degree of efficacy. The Moderna and the Pfizer products are 94 to 95% efficacious. So if we get, and I've made an estimate, it's purely an estimate, about 70 to 85% of the population vaccinated, I believe we would have what's called an umbrella or a blanket of herd immunity over the country. And if the rest of the world does that, we could crush this outbreak. Absolutely. Vaccine is the answer. Until we get a vaccine, we must concentrate very, very clearly on the public health measures that we talk about all the time, namely uniform wearing of masks, keeping physical distancing, avoiding crowds and congregate settings, particularly indoors, and washing your hands frequently. That should be the bridge to the vaccine. But if we can get the overwhelming majority of people vaccinated, we can put an end to this outbreak.
The vaccine rollout in the U.S. has been off to a slow start in so many areas. What do you see as being the biggest holdup?
Well, I think there are a number of things that are going on. Right now, we are still in the very early stages. Whenever you introduce a massive program, the likes of which we've not had before, namely vaccinating essentially all of the country or the overwhelming majority of the country with a brand new vaccine program, that, not surprisingly, can get off with some bumps in the road and some hiccups. Having said that, that's not an excuse. We've got to do better. We must do better. What I'm saying is that let's give it a week or so into January to see if the process can catch up with the pace that had originally been put forth.
Another key feature of the U.S. health system is this kind of state level versus federal and then local. And in terms of vaccine delivery, the Trump administration has left it up to the states to sort out the vaccine delivery. Is that the right way to proceed? And do you see that changing under a Biden administration?
Yes, no doubt it's going to change, because in the discussions that I've had in my new role of being part of the COVID team and the general public health team of the Biden group, is that we will have a much more close interaction between the federal and the state level in the sense of planning together as well as implementation and support. Right now, the issue that is confronting us is that we need to more efficiently get vaccines into the arms of people. We have more vaccine distributed than we've actually put into the arms of individuals. We need to do better with the doses we have.
When it comes to who gets a vaccine, in Nebraska, the governor initially said that undocumented immigrants would not be included in plans to vaccinate workers at meatpacking plants. What are the repercussions of bringing immigration status into vaccine eligibility and priority?
I mean, from a public health repercussion, you've got to get people vaccinated. It doesn't matter who they are. If you're in the country, you're a threat of getting infected yourself and of transmitting the infection. So there's no room for, you know, any withholding of vaccines for people. because they're part of the population that we're dealing with.
Do you see any successful models from elsewhere in the world that the U.S. could emulate?
Well, I don't think so, because no one has yet gotten into this in a really large, meaningful way. This is really quite unprecedented. There have been situations that, if you go historically, not as an example of what other countries are doing, because each country is different, depending upon the size and the health system. For example, those countries that have national health services where everything is interconnected, it can generally be much easier to implement something like this. But if you go back in history and look at times when we've had to do mass vaccination programs, there likely could be some lessons learned there. There is a very interesting historical story about that. In 1947, we had someone visit as a tourist Mexico and then come back to the United States, having contracted smallpox in Mexico, came back to New York City and actually infected a bunch of people. There were 12 hospitalizations and 2 deaths. New York City, in response to that, did a massive vaccination program. And in a 3-week period, they vaccinated 6,350,000 people. And within 2 weeks, they vaccinated 5 million people just in New York City. Of note, I was a 6-year-old boy who was one of those 6,350,000 people that were vaccinated in New York. So wow. If New York City can vaccinate 6,350,000 people in 3 weeks, and that's only one city, then we can go back and get some lessons learned how that was done and get it done countrywise.
Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He's widely recognized as the leading U.S. voice on controlling the coronavirus pandemic. Thank you very much for your time today.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
As Dr. Fauci just mentioned, there's a lot to learn from disease outbreaks of the past. Polio ravaged the globe for decades. The virus infected and paralyzed millions of people worldwide. As the world's Alana Gordon reports, some lessons from the response to polio are being applied today to the coronavirus pandemic.
Ramesh Ferris is Canadian. He lives in the Yukon, but he was born in 1980 in the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu. That's where he got polio as an infant.
The virus paralyzed my legs for life.
As a result, he has no leg muscles. But thanks to surgeries, a leg brace, and a cane, he can get around on his own.
And so I propel myself forward just through the strength of my arms or the swing of my leg.
Ferris, who's 41 now, has gotten around a lot. He's traveled the world as a polio activist with Rotary International. If you look at any photo of him posing with world leaders, queens, and presidents, one thing stands out. He's always wearing shorts.
The reason why is because people don't know what polio is unless they see my legs, right? And it's like a forgotten about disease, right? It's out of sight, out of mind.
Like COVID-19, polio is a contagious virus, but it spreads through contact with infected poop, through contaminated water or food. In the 1980s, vaccines for polio existed, but the virus was still a constant threat in more than 100 countries. In 1988, global health leaders set out on a super ambitious plan. They created an initiative to eradicate polio once and for all.
I mean, for me, it was a very exciting moment, an incredible moment.
Michel Zaffron was director of that initiative up until last week. He just retired. He says the only other disease the world had ever eradicated was smallpox. So this polio plan was a big deal. But polio requires meticulous tracking. Just one infection can easily spread. So they wanted to build a public health infrastructure to deal with that.
We've had to put in place sort of a surveillance system which has been much more sophisticated.
The initiative set up new labs, trained contact tracers, and created a sewage detection system. It raised billions of dollars and brought together the World Health Organization, UNICEF, the CDC, local governments, and others to figure out new ways to collaborate.
The Polio Eradication Initiative shows how working together can achieve an extraordinary goal.
This past year, it celebrated a huge win. Africa was finally declared free of wild polio. Zaffron says the Polio Initiative has now become a blueprint for the global effort to combat COVID-19. Those systems and global partnerships were all ready to go.
All of these lessons, the lab, network, the surveillance officers network, and also now the environmental surveillance efforts that is put in place is actually serving the detection and response to the COVID pandemic.
But Saffron says the success story of the polio initiative is complicated, even messy. And that means it has some big cautionary lessons, too.
We, the world and the program, underestimated the difficulties. We thought we'd be done by 2000, but we're not done yet.
Today, the wild polio virus is still in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Saffron says fatigue has set in, with communities tired of polio workers coming through. They have bigger concerns about food and water. Some worry that complacence could fuel the next big outbreak. In India, it wasn't until 2014 that the country was declared polio-free. Dr. Navin Thacker is director of the International Pediatric Association, though in India especially, he says he's known as Mr. Polio.
If you prepare any strategy based on only science, don't take the human factors into the consideration, then you cannot succeed.
Thacker says there's never a one-size-fits-all approach. They learned the hard way that some polio vaccines worked better or worse in different contexts. And above all, governments, local leaders, and the communities themselves have to take real ownership for any of it to work.
It's the trust. You know, this is the question of trust. You have to build trust, and if you have trust, people will take vaccine.
For Ramesh Ferris, the polio survivor, one thing still haunts him. He was born in 1980. A vaccine for polio had been around since 1955. But he, like so many others, just wasn't able to get vaccinated. Ferris says it pains him to even begin to imagine anything like that scenario playing out with COVID-19.
The only way we're going to move forward to getting back to normal is to ensure that every person has equal access to the vaccines.
Ferris is spending his time hammering home this message about the need for widespread access to vaccines and for the world to not let its guard down on other contagious diseases like polio. And in case anyone forgets what's at stake and the lessons from the past, he'll be wearing shorts as a reminder. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
Beyond the mayhem at the U.S. Capitol, there was another major story in Washington this week. Democrats took control of the Senate after both seats in a special runoff election in Georgia went Democrat. Many of the state's voters who put the Democrats in charge were people of color. Reporter Martha Dalton is in Atlanta. She reports for WABE and also for our Every 30 Seconds series that looks at the Latino electorate. Hey, Martha.
Hi, Carol.
I know you've been closely following these Senate races. How decisive were votes by people of color in the victories of John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock?
Well, it's important to remember we don't have an official analysis yet, but so far it looks like there were just under 70,000 Latino voters, and so that's about 2.5% of the vote total. Asian American voter turnout was a little higher than that, about 77,000. But really, the strongest turnout for Democrats came from the African American voters, and they made up about a third of the overall votes.
In your conversations with Latino organizers in these past few weeks, did they predict or say anything about how decisive the Latino vote was going to be?
Well, organizers here have known for years that the Latino electorate in Georgia is big enough to swing close elections like these were. The question was, could they mobilize people and get them out to the polls, especially in the middle of a pandemic? And the answer seems to be yes, they did. 70,000 voters may not seem like a lot, but Democrat John Ossoff won his race by a much thinner margin than that. And when I talked with an organizer named Tanya Unsueta, she said some of the big issues that Latinos are concerned about and that would get them to the polls are healthcare, you know, COVID, the economy.
Do we know how 70,000 Latino voters compares to eligible Latino voters?
Right. Well, there are about 250,000 eligible Latino voters. So it's not the majority of eligible voters, but it's enough to really make a difference, again, in, you know, tight races like these.
I know in November for the general election, first-time voters were highly galvanized. Was that the case again for this special election?
Well, young voters, yes, that's right. Again, these are early numbers, but it looks like 12% of voters were under the age of 30. About a quarter of voters in the runoffs were under the age of 40. So I'll add that the Democratic candidates, especially John Ossoff, were very adept at reaching younger voters. They leveraged social media. And Ossoff especially had a big following on the site TikTok, which is popular with young people.
Martha Dalton, a reporter at WABE in Atlanta, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great to be with you, Carol. Thank you.
A quick correction before the break. There was a tweet attributed to German Chancellor Angela Merkel that made the rounds this week. It said, compared to the chaos playing out in Washington, her departure from office would be boring. The problem is, the tweet was not from Merkel's official account. We fell for the gag and mentioned it in yesterday's show, and we regret the mistake. You can read more about international reaction to the news here in the U.S. Head over to our website, theworld.org. Check out our podcast feed. And we're on Instagram, too, where you'll find great photos that take you to the heart of the big global stories of the day. Follow us there and add your thoughts. We're at theworld.org/Instagram. The attack on the U.S. Capitol this week by extremist Trump supporters was shocking. Lives were lost. Property was destroyed. For many Americans, it was a deeply depressing moment for what it says about the divisions here. For some people outside the U.S., though, in countries that are usually considered unstable, it was a moment for, well, some mockery. One Iraqi analyst tweeted, "Iraq calls on the U.S. regime to respect the principles of democracy, or it will intervene militarily to bring down the dictator." Pretty obvious what he's referring to there. And a Palestinian-American scholar tweeted this, "The U.S. exported so much democracy that it doesn't have any left." I decided to see what Carl Sharrow has been thinking over the past few days. By day, he's a Lebanese architect who lives and works in London. By night, he's a satirist who tweets and blogs under the name Carl Remarks. Carl, give us some examples of what you've been tweeting the past couple days.
So the tweet that I tweeted, and that was on the 6th of January when the story was breaking, it was protesters storm parliament in this former British colony, etc. And by etc., I meant, you know, you could just sort of develop your own story based on that template. And obviously the tweet that I referred to earlier, which was looking back at the last 4 years, Trump basically imported the U.S.'s foreign policy to the U.S. The follow-up was, and this is in the voice of the president, but you said that the president is in charge of coups, instability, and strife. And they reply, "We meant abroad, Mr. President, not here."
I assume you read the Arabic press pretty carefully. Are there quips and jokes and tweets that in Arabic that have caught your eye?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think it's an opportunity that follows the same theme, but not from press. I think the one that I really liked is, we've had this ongoing demonstrations, a series of demonstrations in Lebanon for a number of years now. The last wave, I think it's a year and a half. And the protesters have been trying to reach parliament for a year and a half, and the army and the security forces stopped them hundreds of meters away before they can get to it. So one of the funniest ones that I saw is, like, "We've been trying for a year and a half and we can't get more than 200 meters closer to the parliament. It took the Americans half an hour to enter the parliament." And, you know, that was kind of a bitter irony to it. In fact, I would go as far to say as, you know, social media today is more effective as these things than the traditional press. But you see and read echoes of this kind of sentiment in the Arabic press across the board.
There's certainly been a fair amount of trolling going on. We've got Erdogan in Turkey, Putin in Russia, the Chinese government. They've all been piling on and rubbing it in Americans' faces. Do you think that holds any sway, or do people see through it?
Nah, to be honest, I think it's very tongue-in-cheek and people do see through it. Although to me, it goes back to a serious issue, which is a lot of my American friends, you know, been having this conversation for years now, and, you know, they sort of say, "Why is all of this a big joke to you? Why do you keep laughing about it?" And my response, aside from the fact that I'm satirist, is since the beginning that, you know, presidents like Trump are a test of the resilience of the democratic system. And if you successfully ride it out and accept the result of the democratic process, that is the best way to respond to it. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people were in denial and tried to kind of show this as some sort of irreversible departure from whatever norm they thought prevailed. And I think to me that exhibited, contrary to what they believe, is a lack of commitment to democracy and democratic principles, as in the more robust response would have been, you know, that happens, let's be reflexive, let's be introspective, let's understand the reason and come up with a response, rather than what I see really happening, which is a lot of restriction on social media, a lot of restrictions on freedom of speech, a kind of almost like wanting to have a more enlightened authoritarian state to prevent this from happening ever again.
Carl Sharrow is a Lebanese satirist. He blogs and tweets under the name Carl Remarks. Thanks a lot, Carl.
Thank you so much, Carl.
And now a story that is not about politics or the fate of the Republic. It's about fruit. Yep, we're public radio. So when you go to the grocery store, there's a lot of apples to choose from. Granny Smith, Gala, Red Delicious, to name a few. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. Around the world, thousands of apple varieties exist. Now add one more to the list. A British man named Archie Thomas was recently on a run in the countryside near his home in southwest England when he stumbled across a fallen apple unlike any he'd seen before. It was yellow with mottled brown spots, the size of a grapefruit. Check out a picture of it on our Twitter feed. We're at The World. Now, Thomas is a longtime nature lover, and he was keen to identify the fruit, so he sent three of the apples to the Royal Horticulture Society. Yep, very British. They landed on the desk of fruit specialist Jim Arbery, who usually inspects more than 1,000 apples every year.
But most of those will be apples that I can identify quite easily, and many of them popular apples.
Not this one. Arbery got to work testing the apple and cross-checking it with the thousands that are already documented.
Tasting them, cutting them up, looking at the descriptions. It's got quite pleasant flavour, little bit of acidity, balancing acidity, and some tannins.
Arbery cooked a few slices too to see if the flesh held up. It did. And all these tests told him this was not a previously known fruit. Arbery estimated that the apple's tree could be 100 years old, and the newly discovered variety was likely a result of cross-pollination.
A bee or another pollinating insect would have carried pollen from one apple tree to another apple tree. Then you get the two sets of DNA coming together.
Nature doing its thing. Arbery says he's only identified a handful of new apple varieties in his entire career. But hang on, a DNA test is needed to definitively prove that the new apple is indeed unique. In the meantime, Archie Thomas, the guy who found the apple, told us he's taking great care in choosing a name for the new fruit for when it becomes official. The fun part, he said, the challenge, coming up with a name that will weather the test of time. Let's take a bite out of a new song from the Australian band The Jungle Giants. It's called In Her Eyes.
She said, I don't want your money, babe. I just want your hand.
The four-piece band from Melbourne were supposed to do a world tour last year. Then, of course, the pandemic hit and everything was called off. Hunkered down, down under, the group got to work on a new album. When lockdowns and travel bans are lifted, The Jungle Giants hope to hit the road. And that's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman is back in the host chair on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend.